Blind Sight, Disc 5.
Saristi stayed behind. He hadn't come with a backup. There were the rest of us, though, crammed into the shuttle, embedded in customs spacesuits so padded with shielding we might have been deep-sea divers from a previous century. It was a fine balance. Too much shielding would have been worse than none at all, would split primary particles into secondary ones, just as lethal and twice as numerous. Sometimes you had to live with moderate exposure. The only alternative was to embed yourself like a bug in lead. We launched 6 hours from perigee. Scylla raced on ahead like an eager child, leaving its parent behind. There was no eagerness in the systems around me, though, except for one. The gang of four almost shimmered behind her faceplate. "Excited?" I asked. Sasha answered, "Fucking right! Field work, Keaton! First contact!" "What if there's nobody there?" "What if there is and they don't like us?" "Even better! We get a crack at their signs and cereal boxes without their traffic cops leaning over our shoulders." I wondered if she spoke for the others. I was pretty sure she didn't speak for Michelle. Scylla's ports had all been sealed. There was no outside view, nothing to see inside but bots and bodies and the tangled silhouettes swelling on my helmet HUD. But I could feel the radiation slicing through our armor as if it were tissue paper. I could feel the knotted crests and troughs of Rorschach's magnetic field. I could feel Rorschach itself, drawing nearer, the charred canopy of some firestormed alien forest, more landscape than artifact. I imagined titanic bolts of electricity arcing between its branches. I imagined getting in the way. What kind of creatures would choose to live in such a place? "You really think we'll get along?" I said. James's shrug was all but lost under the armor. "Maybe not at first. We may have gotten off on the wrong foot. We might have to sort through all kinds of misunderstandings. But we'll figure each other out eventually." Evidently, she thought that had answered my question. The shuttle slewed. We bumped against each other like tenpins. 30 seconds of micro-maneuvers brought us to a solid stop. A cheery animation played across the HUD in greens and blues, the shuttle's docking seal easing through the membrane that served as our entrance into Rorschach's inflatable vestibule. Even as a cartoon, it looked vaguely pornographic. Bates had been pre-packed next to the airlock. She slid back the inner door. "Everybody duck!" Not an easy maneuver, swaddled in life support and ferro-ceramic. Helmets tilted and bumped. The grunts, flattened overhead like great lethal cockroaches, hummed to life and disengaged from the ceiling. They scraped past in the narrow headroom, bobbed cryptically to their mistress, and exited stage left. Bates closed the inner hatch. The lock cycled, opened again on an empty chamber. "Everything nominal, according to the board." The drones waited patiently in the vestibule. Nothing had jumped out at them. Bates followed them through. We had to wait forever for the image. The baud rate was less than a trickle. Words moved back and forth easily enough. "No surprises so far," Bates reported in distorted Jew's harp vibrato. "But any picture was worth a million of them, and there." Through the eyes of the grunt behind, we saw the grunt ahead in motionless, grainy monochrome. It was a postcard from the past. Sight turned to sound, thick, clumsy vibrations of methane bumping against the hull. It took long seconds for each static-ridden image to accrete on the HUD. Grunts descended into the pit, grunts emerging into Rorschach's duodenum, a cryptic, hostile cavescape in systematic increments. Down in the lower left-hand corner of each image, timestamps and Teslas ran down the clock. "You give up a lot when you don't trust the EM spectrum." "Looks good," Bates reported. "Going in." In a friendlier universe, machines would have cruised the boulevard, sending perfect images in crystal resolution. Spindle and the gang would be sipping coffee back in the drum, telling the grunts to take a sample of this or get a close-up of that. In a friendlier universe, I wouldn't even be here. Bates appeared in the next postcard, emerging from the fistula. In the next, her back was to the camera, apparently panning the perimeter. In the one after that, she was looking right at us. "Oh, okay," she said. "Come on down." "Not so fast," Spindle said. "How are you feeling?" "Fine. A bit odd, but..." "Odd how?" Radiation sickness announced itself with nausea, but unless we'd seriously erred in our calculations, that wouldn't happen for another hour or two. Not until well after we'd all been lethally cooked. "Mild disorientation," Bates reported. "It's a bit spooky in here, but must be Gray syndrome. It's tolerable." I looked at the gang. The gang looked at Spindle. Spindle shrugged. "It's not going to get any better," Bates said from afar. The clock is ticking, people. Get down here." We got. Not living, not by a long shot. Haunted. Even when the walls didn't move, they did. Always at the corner of the eye, that sense of crawling motion. Always at the back of the mind, the sense of being watched, the dread certainty of malign and alien observers just out of sight. More than once I turned, expecting to catch one of those phantoms in the open. All I ever saw was a half-blind grunt floating down the passageway, or a wide-eyed and jittery crewmate returning my stare. And the walls of some glistening black lava tube with 100 embedded eyes all snapped shut just the instant before. Our lights pushed the darkness back perhaps 20 meters in either direction. Beyond, mist and shadows seethed. And the sounds! Rorschach creaked around us like some ancient wooden hull trapped in pack ice. Electricity hissed like rattlesnakes. You tell yourself it's mostly in your head. You remind yourself it's well documented, an inevitable consequence of meat and magnetism brought too close together. High energy fields release the ghosts and the grays from your temporal lobe, dredge up paralyzing dread from the midbrain to saturate the conscious mind. They fuck with your motor nerves and make even dormant inlays sing like fine, fragile crystal. Energy artifacts, that's all they are. You repeat that to yourself. You repeat it so often it loses any pretense of rationality and devolves into rote incantation, a spell to ward off evil spirits. They're not real, these whispering voices just outside your helmet, those half-seen creatures flickering at the edge of vision. They're tricks of the mind, the same neurological smoke and mirrors that convinced people throughout the ages that they were being haunted by ghosts, abducted by aliens, hunted by vampires. And you wonder whether Saresti really stayed behind, or if he was here all along, waiting for you. "Another spike," Bates warned as Tesla and Sievert surged on my HUD. "Hang on." I was installing the Faraday bell. Trying to. It should have been simple enough. I'd already run the main anchor line down from the vestibule to the flaccid sack floating in the middle of the passageway. That's right, something about a spring line. To keep the bell centered. The wall glistened in my headlamp like wet clay. Satanic runes sparkled in my imagination. I jammed the spring line's pad against the wall. I could have sworn the substrate flinched. I fired my thrust pistol, retreated back to the center of the passage. "They're here," James whispered. Something was. I could feel it was always behind me, no matter where I turned. I could feel some great roaring darkness swirling just out of sight, a ravenous mouth as wide as the tunnel itself. Any moment now it would lunge forward at impossible speed and engulf us all. "They're beautiful," James said. There was no fear in her voice at all. She sounded awestruck. "What? Where?" Bates never stopped turning, kept trying to keep the whole 360 in sight at once. The drones under her command wobbled restlessly to either side, armored parentheses pointing down the passageway in opposite directions. "What do you see?" "Not out there. In here. Everywhere. Can't you see it?"
"I can't see anything," Spindle said, his voice shaking.
"It's in the EM fields," James said. "That's how they communicate. The whole structure is full of language. It's, 'I can't see anything,'" Spindle repeated. His breath echoed loud and fast over the link. "I'm blind." "Shit," Bates swung on Spindle. "How can that—"
"The radiation.
I don't think that's it." 9 Tesla and the ghosts were everywhere. I smelled asphalt and honeysuckle. "Keaton," Bates called. "You with us?"
Yeah.
Barely. I was back at the bell, my hand on the ripcord, trying to ignore whatever kept tapping me on the shoulder. "Leave that. Get him outside."
"No."
Spindle floated helplessly in the passage, his pistol bouncing against its wrist tether.
"No. Throw me something."
"What?" "It's all in your head. It's all in your—"
"Throw something, anything."
Bates hesitated. "You said you were blind. Just do it." Bates pulled a spare suit battery off her belt and lobbed it. Spindle reached, fumbled. The battery slipped from his grasp and bounced off the wall.
"I'll be okay," he gasped. "Just get me into the tent."
I yanked the cord. The bell inflated like a great gunmetal marshmallow. "Everyone inside." Bates ran her pistol with one hand, grabbed Spindle with the other. She handed him off to me and slapped a sensor pod under the skin of the tent. I pulled back the shielded entrance flap as though pulling a scab from a wound. The single molecule beneath, infinitely long, endlessly folded against itself, swirled and glistened like a soap bubble.
"Get him in! James, get down here!"
I pushed Spindle through the membrane. It split around him with airtight intimacy, hugged each tiny crack and contour as he passed through.
"James, are you—"
"Get it off me!"
Harsh voice, raw and scared and scary, as male as female could sound. Cruncher in control.
"Get it off!"
I looked back. Susan James's body tumbled slowly in the tunnel, grasping its right leg with both hands.
"James!"
Bates sailed over to the other woman. "Keaton, help out!" She took the gang by the arm.
"Cruncher, what's the problem?"
"That! You blind?"
He wasn't just grasping at the limb, I realized as I joined them. He was tugging at it. He was trying to pull it off. Something laughed hysterically right inside my helmet.
"Take his arm," Bates told me, taking his right one, trying to pry the fingers from their death grip on the gang's leg. "Cruncher, let go. Now." "Get it off me."
"It's your leg, Cruncher."
We wrestled our way toward the diving bell.
"It's not my leg. Just look at it. How could it? It's dead. It's stuck to me."
"Almost there."
"Cruncher, listen," Bates snapped. "Are you with me? Get it off."
We stuffed the gang into the tent. Bates moved aside as I dove in after them. Amazing the way she held it together. Somehow she kept the demons at bay, herded us to shelter like a border collie in a thunderstorm. She wasn't following us in. She wasn't even there. I turned to see her body floating outside the tent, one gloved hand grasping the edge of the flap. But even under all those layers of captain and chromel and polycarbonate, even behind the distorted half-reflections on her faceplate, I could tell that something was missing. All her surfaces had just disappeared. This couldn't be Amanda Bates. The thing before me had no more topology than a mannequin.
"Amanda?"
The gang gibbered at my back, softly hysteric. "Spindle,
what's happening?"
"I'll stay out here," Bates said. She had no affect whatsoever. "I'm dead anyway."
"What?"
Spindle had lots.
"You will be if you don't—"
"You leave me here," Bates said. "That's an order." She sealed us in. It wasn't the first time, not for me.
I'd had invisible fingers poking through my brain before, stirring up the muck, ripping open the scabs. It was far more intense when Rorschach did it to me. But Chelsea was more precise, I guess you'd say. Macrame, she called it. Glial jumpstarts, cascade effects, the splice and dice of critical ganglia. While I trafficked in the reading of human architecture, Chelsea changed it, finding the critical nodes and nudging them just so, dropping a pebble into some trickle at the headwaters of memory and watching the ripples build to a great rolling cascade deep in the downstream psyche. She could hotwire happiness in the time it took to fix a sandwich, reconcile you with your whole childhood in the course of a lunch hour or three. Like so many other domains of human invention, this one had learned to run without her. Human nature was becoming an assembly line edit, humanity itself increasingly relegated from production to product. Still, for me, Chelsea's skill set recast a strange old world in an entirely new light. The cut and paste of minds not for the greater good of some abstract society, but for the simple selfish wants of the individual. "Let me give you the gift of happiness," she said. "I'm already pretty happy." "I'll make you happier. A tat on me." "Tat?" "Transient attitudinal tweak. I've still got privileges at Saks." "I've been tweaked plenty. Change one more synapse and I might turn into someone else." "That's ridiculous and you know it. Or every experience you had would turn you into a different person." I thought about that. Maybe it does. But she wouldn't let it go, and even the strongest anti-happiness argument was bound to be an uphill proposition. So one afternoon, Chelsea fished around in her cupboards and dredged up a hairnet studded with greasy gray washers. The net was a superconducting spider web, fine as mist, that mapped the fields of merest thought. The washers were ceramic magnets that bathed the brain in fields of their own. Chelsea's inlays linked to a base station that played with the interference patterns between the two. They used to need a machine the size of a bathroom just to house the magnets. She laid me back on the couch and stretched the mesh across my skull. "That's the only outright miracle you get with a portable setup like this. We can find hot spots, and we can even zap them if they need zapping, but TMS effects fade after a while. We'll have to go to the clinic for anything permanent." "So we're fishing for what, exactly? Repressed memories?" "No such thing," she grinned in toothy reassurance. "There are only memories we choose to ignore or kind of think around, if you know what I mean. I thought this was the gift of happiness. Why," she laid a fingertip across my lips, "believe it or not, Siggers, people sometimes choose to ignore even good memories. Like, say, if they enjoyed something they didn't think they should, or," she kissed my forehead, "if they don't think they deserve to be happy. So we're going for potluck. You can never tell till you get a bite. Close your eyes." A soft hum started up somewhere between my ears. Chelsea's voice led me on through the darkness. "Now keep in mind, memories aren't historical archives. They're improvisations, really. A lot of stuff you associate with a particular event might be factually wrong, no matter how clearly you remember it. The brain has a funny habit of building composites, inserting details after the fact. But that's not to say your memories aren't true, okay? They're an honest reflection of how you saw the world, and every one of them went into shaping how you see it. But they're not photographs. More like impressionist paintings. Okay?" "Okay." "Ah," she said, "there's something." "What?" "Functional cluster. Getting a lot of low-level use, but not enough to intrude into conscious awareness. Let's just see what happens when we..." And I was 10 years old. And I was home early, and I just let myself into the kitchen, and the smell of burned butter and garlic hung in the air. Dad and Helen were fighting in the next room. The flip-top on our kitchen catcher had been left up, which was sometimes enough to get Helen going all by itself. But they were fighting about something else. Helen only wanted what was best for all of us, but Dad said there were limits, and this was not the way to go about it. And Helen said, "You don't know what it's like, you hardly ever even see him." And then I knew they were fighting about me, which in and of itself was nothing unusual. What really scared me was that for the first time ever, Dad was fighting back. "You do not force something like that onto someone, especially without their knowledge." My father never shouted. His voice was as low and level as ever, but it was colder than I'd ever heard, and hard as iron. "That's just garbage," Helen said. "Parents always make decisions for their children in their best interests, especially when it comes to medical issues." "This is not a medical issue." This time my father's voice did rise. "It's not a medical issue. That's a new height of denial, even for you. They cut out half his brain in case you missed it. Do you think he can recover from that without help? Is that more of your father's tough love shining through? Why not just deny him food and water while you're at it?" If muops were called for, they'd have been prescribed. I felt my face crunching at the unfamiliar word. Something small and white beckoned from the open garbage pail. "Jim, be reasonable. He's so distant, he barely even talks to me." They said it would take time. "But 2 years? There's nothing wrong with helping nature along a little. We're not even talking black market. It's over the counter, for God's sake." "That's not the point." An empty pill bottle. That's what one of them had thrown out before forgetting to close the lid. I salvaged it from the kitchen discards and sounded out the label in my head. Maybe the point should be that someone who's barely home 3 months of the year has got a bloody nerve passing judgment on my parenting skills. If you want a say in how he's raised, then you can damn well pay some dues first. Until then, just fuck right off. "You will not put that shit into my son ever again," my father said. Bondfast, trademark Formula 4. Mu opioid receptor promoters, maternal response stimulant. Strengthening ties between mother and child since 2042. "Yeah, and how are you going to stop me, you little geek? You can't even make the time to find out what's going on in your own family. You think you can control me all the way from fucking orbit? You think..." Suddenly nothing came from the living room but soft choking sounds. I peeked around the corner. My father had Helen by the throat. "I think," he growled, "that I can stop you from doing anything to Siri ever again if I have to. And I think you know that." And then she saw me. And then he did. And my father took his hand from around my mother's neck. And his face was utterly unreadable. But there was no mistaking the triumph on hers. I was up off the couch, the skullcap clenched in one hand. Chelsea stood wide-eyed before me, the butterfly still as death on her cheekbone. She took my hand. "Oh, God, I'm so sorry." You saw that?" "No, of course not. It can't read minds, but that obviously... wasn't a happy memory." "Wasn't all that bad." I felt sharp, disembodied pain from somewhere nearby, like an ink spot on a white tablecloth. After a moment, I fixed it, teeth in my lip. She ran her hand up my arm. "It really stressed you out. Your vitals were... Are you okay?" "Yeah, of course, no big deal." Tasting salt. "I am curious about something, though."
"Ask me."
"Why would you do this to me?"
"Because we can make it go away, Cygnus. That's the whole point. Whatever that was, whatever you didn't like about it, we know where it is now. We can go back in and damp it out just like that. And then we've got days to get it removed permanently, if that's what you want. Just put the cap back on and..."
She put her arms around me, drew me close. She smelled like sand and sweat. I loved the way she smelled. For a while, I could feel a little bit safe. For a while, I could feel like the bottom wasn't going to drop out at any moment. Somehow, when I was with Chelsea, I mattered.
I wanted her to hold me forever.
I don't think so, I said.
No? She blinked, looked up at me. Why ever not?
I shrugged. You know what they say about people who don't remember the past.
Predators run for their dinner, prey run for their lives. Old ecologist's proverb. We were blind and helpless, jammed into a fragile bubble behind enemy lines. But finally the whisperers were silent. The monsters had stayed beyond the covers. And Amanda Bates was out there with them.
What the fuck? Spindle breathed.
The eyes behind his faceplate were active and searching. You can see? I asked. He nodded.
What happened to Bates? Her suit breach?
I don't think so.
Then why'd she say she was dead? What?
She meant it literally, I told him. Not I'm as good as dead or I'm going to die. She meant dead now, like she was a talking corpse.
How do you...
You know? Stupid question. His face ticked and trembled in the helmet.
That's crazy, eh?
Define crazy. The gang floated quietly, cheek to jowl behind Spindle in the cramped enclosure. Cruncher had stopped obsessing about the leg as soon as we'd sealed up. Or maybe he'd simply been overridden. I thought I saw facets of Susan in the twitching of those thick-gloved fingers. Spindle's breath echoed secondhand over the link.
If Bates is dead, then so are we.
Maybe not. We wait out the spike, we get out of here. Besides, I added, she wasn't dead, she only said she was.
Fuck.
Spindle reached out and pressed his gloved palm against the skin of the tent. He felt back and forth along the fabric.
Someone did put out a transducer.
8 o'clock, I said, about a meter. Spindle's hand came to rest across the wall from the pod. My HUD flooded with secondhand numbers, vibrated down his arm and relayed to our suits. Still 5 Tesla out there. Falling, though. The tent expanded around us as if breathing, shrank back in the next second as some transient low-pressure front moved past.
When did your sight come back? I wondered.
Soon as we came inside.
Sooner. You saw the battery.
Fumbled it, he grunted. Not that I'm much less of a spaz even when I'm not blind, eh?
Bates, you out there?
You reached for it. You almost caught it. That wasn't blind chance.
Not blind chance. Blind sight.
Amanda, respond, please.
Blind sight?
Nothing wrong with the receptors, he said distractedly. Brain processes the image but can't access it. Brainstem takes over.
Your brainstem can see but you can't?
Something like that. Shut up and let me...
Amanda, can you hear me?
No.
Not from anyone in the tent, that voice. It had shivered down Spindle's arm, barely audible with the rest of the data. From outside.
Major Mandy, Spindle exclaimed. You're alive.
No.
A whisper like white noise.
Well, you're talking to us, so you sure as shit ain't dead.
No.
Spindle and I exchanged looks.
What's the problem, Major?
Silence. The gang bumped gently against the wall behind us, all facets opaque.
Major Bates, can you hear me?
No.
It was a dead voice, sedated, trapped in a fishbowl, transmitted through limbs and lead at a 3-digit baud rate. But it was definitely Bates's voice.
Major, you gotta get in here, Spindle said. Can you come inside?
No.
Are you injured? Are you pinned by something?
No. Maybe not her voice, after all. Maybe just her vocal cords.
Look, Amanda, it's dangerous. It's too damn hot out there. Do you understand?
I'm not out here, said the voice.
Where are you?
Nowhere.
I looked at Spindle. Spindle looked at me. Neither of us spoke. James did, at long last and softly,
And what are you, Amanda?
No answer.
Are you Rorschach?
Here in the belly of the beast, it was so easy to believe.
No.
Then what?
Nothing.
The voice was flat and mechanical.
I'm nothing.
You're saying you don't exist?
Spindle said slowly.
Yes.
The tent breathed around us.
Then how can you speak? Susan asked the voice. If you don't exist, what are we talking to?
Something else.
A sigh, a breath of static.
Not me.
Shit,
Spindle muttered. His surfaces brightened with resolve and sudden insight. He pulled his hand from the wall. My HUD thinned instantly.
Her brain's frying. We gotta get her inside.
He reached for the release. I put out my own hand.
The spike crested already, Commissar. We're past the worst of it.
Are you saying it's safe?
It's lethal. It's always lethal, and she's out there in it, and she can do some serious damage to herself in her present...
Something bumped the tent from the outside. Something grabbed the outer catch and pulled. Our shelter opened like an eye. Amanda Bates looked in at us through the exposed membrane.
I'm reading 3.8, she said. That's tolerable, right?
Nobody moved.
Come on, people, break's over.
Spindle stared.
Are you okay?
In here, not likely, but we got a job to do.
Do you exist? I asked.
What kind of stupid question is that? Spindle, how's this field strength? Can we work in it? He swallowed audibly.
Maybe we should abort, Major. That spike was,
according to my readings, the spike is pretty much over, and we've got less than 2 hours to finish setting up, run our ground truths, and get out of here. Can we do that without hallucinating?
I don't think we'll shake the heebie-jeebies, Spindle admitted, but we shouldn't have to worry about extreme effects until another spike hits.
Good.
Which could be any time.
We weren't hallucinating, James said quietly. We can discuss it later, Bates said. Now, there was a pattern there, James insisted. In the fields, in my head, Rorschach was talking. Maybe not to us, but it was talking.
Good.
Bates pushed herself back to let us pass. Maybe now we can finally learn to talk back.
Maybe we can learn to listen, James said.
We fled like frightened children with brave faces. We left a base camp behind. Jack, still miraculously functional in its vestibule, a tunnel into the haunted mansion, forlorn magnetometers left to die in the faint hope that they might not, crude pyranometers and thermographs, antique radiation-proof devices that measured the world through the flex and stretch of metal tabs and etched their findings on rolls of plastic. Glow globes and diving bells and guide ropes strung one to another, we left it all behind and promised to return in 36 hours if we lived so long. Inside each of us, infinitesimal lacerations were turning our cells to mush. Plasma membranes sprang countless leaks. Overwhelmed repair enzymes clung desperately to shredded genes and barely delayed the inevitable. Anxious to avoid the rush, patches of my intestinal lining began flaking away before the rest of the body had a chance to die. By the time we docked with Theseus, both Michelle and I were feeling nauseous. The rest of the gang, oddly, was not. I had no idea how that was possible. The others would be presenting the same symptoms within minutes. Without intervention, we would all be vomiting our guts out for the following 2 days. Then the body would pretend to recover. For perhaps a week, we would feel no pain and have no future. We would walk and talk and move like any living thing, and perhaps convince ourselves that we were immortal after all. Then we would collapse into ourselves, rotted from the inside out. We would bleed from our eyes and mouths and assholes, and if any god was merciful, we would die before splitting open like rotten fruit. But of course, Theseus, our redeemer, would save us from such a fate. We filed from the shuttle into a great balloon that Saraste had erected to capture our personal effects. We shed our contaminated spacesuits and clothing and emerged naked into the spine. We passed single file through the drum, the flying dead in formation. Yuka Saraste, discreetly distant on the turning floor, leapt up in our wake and disappeared aft to feed our radioactive cast-offs into the decompiler. Into the crypt. Our coffins lay open across the rear bulkhead. We sank gratefully and wordlessly into their embrace. Bates coughed blood as the lids came down. My bones hummed as the captain began to shut me off. I went to sleep a dead man. I had only theory and the assurances of fellow machinery that I would ever be born again. Keaton, come forth. I woke up ravenous. Faint voices drifted forward from the drum. I floated in my pod for a few moments, eyes closed, savoring absences. No pain, no nausea. No terrifying subliminal sense of one's own body sloughing incrementally to mush. Weakness and hunger. Otherwise, I felt fine. I opened my eyes. Something like an arm? Gray and glistening, far too attenuate to be human? No hand at its tip. Too many joints. A limb broken in a dozen places. It extended from a body barely visible over the lip of the pod, a suggestion of dark bulk and other limbs in disjoint motion. It hovered motionless before me, as if startled in the midst of some shameful act. By the time I had breath enough to cry out, it had whipped back out of sight. I erupted from the pod, eyes everywhere. Now they saw nothing, an empty crypt, a naked note-taker. The mirrored bulkhead reflected vacant pods to either side. I called up consensus, all systems nominal. It didn't reflect, I remembered. The mirror didn't show it. I headed aft, heart still pounding. The drum opened around me, Spindle and the gang conversing in low tones below. Spindle glanced up and waved a trembling hand in greeting. You need to check me out, I called. My voice wasn't nearly so steady as I'd hoped. Admitting you have a problem is the first step, Spindle called back. Just don't expect miracles. He turned back to the gang, James on top. They sat in a diagnostic couch staring at some test pattern shimmering on the rear bulkhead. I grabbed the tip of a stairway and pulled myself down. Coriolis pushed me sideways like a flag in the breeze. I'm either hallucinating or there's something on board. You're hallucinating. I'm serious. So am I. Take a number. Wait your turn. He was serious. Once I forced myself to calm down and read the signs, I could see he wasn't even surprised. Guess you're pretty hungry after all that exhausting lying around, eh? Spindle waved at the galley. Eat something. Be with you in a few minutes. I forced myself to work up my latest synopsis while I ate, but that only took half a mind. The other half still shivered in residual thrall to fight flight. I tried to distract it by tapping the biomed feed. It was real, James was saying. We all saw it. No, couldn't have been. Spindle cleared his throat. Try this one. The feed showed what she saw. A small black triangle on a white background. In the next instant, it shattered into a dozen identical copies and a dozen. The proliferating brood rotated around the center screen, geometric primitives ballroom dancing in precise formation, each sprouting smaller triangles from its tips, fractalizing, rotating, evolving into an infinite, intricate tile work. A sketch pad, I realized. An interactive eyewitness reconstruction without the verbiage. Susan's own pattern-matching wetware reacted to what she saw. No, there were more of them. No, the orientation's wrong. Yes, that's it, but bigger. And Spindle's machine picked those reactions right out of her head and amended the display in real time. It was a big step up from that half-assed workaround called language. The easily impressed might have even called it mind-reading. It wasn't, though. It was all just feedback and correlation. It doesn't take a telepath to turn one set of patterns into another, fortunately.
That's it. That's it, Susan cried.
The triangles had iterated out of existence. Now the display was full of interlocking asymmetrical pentagrams, a spiderweb of fish scales.
Don't tell us that's random noise, she said triumphantly.
No, Spindle said. It's a Clerval constant.
It's a hallucination, Suze.
Of course, but something planted it in our head, right? And it was in your head all along. It was in your head the day you were born.
No.
It's an artifact of deep brain structure. Even congenitally blind people see them sometimes. None of us have seen them before, ever.
I believe you. But there's no information there, eh? That wasn't Rorschach talking. It was interference, like everything else.
But it was so vivid. Not that flickering corner of your eye stuff we saw everywhere. This was solid. It was realer than real.
That's how you can tell it wasn't. Since you don't actually see it, there's no messy eyeball optics to limit resolution.
Oh, James said, and then softly, shit.
Yeah, sorry.
And then,
anytime you're ready.
I looked up. Spindle was waving me over. James rose from her chair, but it was Michelle who gave him a quick, disconsolate squeeze, and Sasha who grumbled past me on her way to their tent. By the time I reached him, Spindle had unfolded the couch into a half cot.
Lie down.
I did. I wasn't talking about back in Rorschach, you know. I meant here. I saw something right now, when I woke up.
Raise your left hand, he said, then, just your left, eh?
I lowered my right, winced at the pinprick. That's a bit primitive. He eyed the blood-filled cuvette between his thumb and forefinger, a shivering ruby teardrop the size of a fingernail.
Wet samples still best for some things.
Aren't the pods supposed to do everything? Spindle nodded.
Call it a quality control test. Keep the ship on its toes.
He dropped the sample onto the nearest countertop. The teardrop flattened and burst. The surface drank my blood as if parched. Spindle smacked his lips.
Elevated cholinesterase inhibitors in the ret. Yum.
For all I knew, my blood results actually did taste good to the man. Spindle didn't just read results. He felt them, smelled and saw and experienced each datum like drops of citrus on the tongue. The whole biomed subdrum was but a part of the Spindle prosthesis, an extended body with dozens of different sensory modes, forced to talk to a brain that knew only five. No wonder he'd bonded with Michelle. He was almost a synesthesiac himself.
You spent a bit longer in there than the rest of us, he remarked.
That's significant? A jerking shrug.
Maybe your organs got a bit more cooked than ours. Maybe you just got a delicate constitution. Your pod would have caught anything imminent, so I figure...
Ah.
What? Some cells along your brain pan going into overdrive. More in your bladder and kidney.
Tumors?
What do you expect? Rorschach's no rejuve spa.
But the pod, Spindle grimaced, his idea of a reassuring smile,
repairs 99.9% of the damage, sure. By the time you get to the last 0.1, you're into diminishing returns. These are small, Commissar. Chances are your own body will take care of them. If not, we know where they live.
The ones in my brain, could they be causing?
Not a chance.
He chewed on his lower lip for a moment.
Of course, cancer's not all that thing did to us.
What I saw, up in the crypt, it had these multi-jointed arms from a central mass, big as a person, maybe. Spindle nodded.
Get used to it.
The others are seeing these things?
I doubt it. Everyone has a different take, like...
His twitching face conveyed, dare I say it?
Rorschach blots.
I was expecting hallucinations in the field, I admitted. But up here?
TMS effects,
Spindle snapped his fingers. They're sticky, eh? Neurons get kicked into one state, take a while to come unstuck. You never got a tat? Well-adjusted boy like you? Once or twice, I said. Maybe. Same principle. So I'm going to keep seeing this stuff. Party line is they fade over time. Week or two, you're back to normal. But out here with that thing? He shrugged. Too many variables. Not the least of which is, I assume we'll keep going back until Saraste says otherwise. But they're basically magnetic effects. Probably. Although I'm not betting on anything where that fucker's concerned. Could something else be causing them? I asked. Something on this ship? Like what? I don't know. Leakage in Theseus's magnetic shielding, maybe? Not normally. Of course, we've all got a little implanted network in our heads, eh? And you got a whole hemisphere of prosthetics up there. Who knows what kind of side effects those might let you in for? Why? Rorschach not a good enough reason for you? I saw them before, I might have said. And then Spindle would say, oh, when, where? And maybe I'd reply, when I was spying on your private life. And any chance of non-invasive observation would be flushed down to the atoms. It's probably nothing. I've just been jumpy lately. Thought I saw something weird in the spinal bundle back before we landed on Rorschach. Just a second, you know, and it disappeared as soon as I focused on it. Multi-jointed arms with a central mass. God, no, just a flicker, really. It was probably just Amanda's rubber ball floating around up there. Probably. Spindle seemed almost amused. Couldn't hurt to check for leakage in the shielding, though, just in case. Not like we need something else making us see things, eh? I shook my head at remembered nightmares. How are the others? Gang's fine, if a bit disappointed. Haven't seen the Major, he shrugged. Maybe she's avoiding me. It hit her pretty hard. No worse than the rest of us, really. She might not even remember it. How could she possibly believe she didn't even exist? Spindle shook his head. Didn't believe it. Knew it. For a fact. But how? Charge gauge on your car, right? Sometimes the contacts corrode. Readout freezes on empty, so you think it's empty. What else are you supposed to think? Not like you can go in and count the electrons. You're saying the brain's got some kind of existence gauge? Brain's got all kinds of gauges. You can know you're blind even when you're not. You can know you can see even when you're blind. And yeah, you can know you don't exist even when you do. It's a long list, Commissar. Cotard's, Anton's, Damascus disease, just for starters. He hadn't said blind sight. What was it like? I asked. Like? Although he knew exactly what I meant. Did your arm move by itself when it reached for that battery? Oh. Nah. You're still in control. You get a feeling is all. A sense of where to reach. One part of the brain playing charades with another, eh? He gestured at the couch. Get off. Seen enough of your ugly guts for now. And send Bates up if you can find where she's hiding. Probably back at Fab building a bigger army. The misgivings glinted off him like sunlight. You have a problem with her, I said. He started to deny it, then remembered who he was talking to. Not personally, just human node running mechanical infantry, electronic reflexes slave to meat reflexes. You tell me where the weak spot is. Down in Rorschach, I'd have to say all the links are pretty weak. Not talking about Rorschach, Spindle said. We go there. What stops them from coming here? Them. Maybe they haven't arrived yet, he admitted. But when they do, I'm betting we'll be going up against something bigger than anaerobic microbes. When I didn't answer, he continued, his voice lowered. In any way, Mission Control didn't know shit about Rorschach. They thought they were sending us someplace where drones could do all the heavy lifting. But then they just hate not being in command, eh? Can't admit the grunts are smarter than the generals. So our defenses get compromised for political appearances, not like that's any kind of news, and I'm no jarhead, but it strikes me as real bad strategy.
I remembered Amanda Bates midwifing the birth of her troops. I'm more of a safety precaution. Amanda, I began, like Mandy fine. Nice mammal. But if we're cruising into a combat situation, I don't want my ass covered by some network held back by its weakest link.
If you're going to be surrounded by a swarm of killer robots, maybe.
Yeah, people keep saying that. Can't trust the machines. Luddites love to go on about computer malfunctions and how many accidental wars we might have prevented because a human had the final say. But funny thing, Commissar, nobody talks about how many intentional wars got started for the same reason. You're still writing those postcards to posterity?
I nodded and didn't wince inwardly. It was just Spindle.
Well, feel free to stick this conversation in your next one, for all the good it'll do.
Imagine you are a prisoner of war. You've got to admit you saw it coming. You've been crashing tech and seeding biosols for a solid 18 months. That's a good run by anyone's standards. Realist saboteurs do not, as a rule, enjoy long careers. Everyone gets caught eventually. It wasn't always thus. There was a day you might have even hoped for a peaceful retirement, but then they brought the vampires back from the Pleistocene, and great grieving ganja did that ever turn the balance of power upside down. Those fuckers are always 10 steps ahead. It only makes sense. After all, hunting people is what bloodsuckers evolved to do. There's this line from an early Popdine textbook, really old, maybe even Twensen. It had something of a mantra, maybe prayer would be a better word, among those in your profession. Predators run for their dinner, it goes, prey run for their lives. The moral is supposed to be that on average, the hunted escape the hunters because they're more motivated. Maybe that was true when it all just came down to who ran faster. Doesn't seem to hold when the strategy involves tactical foresight and double reverse mindfucks, though. The vampires win every time. And now you're caught. And while it may have been vampires that set the trap, it was regular turncoat baseline humans who pulled the trigger. For 6 hours now, you've been geckoed to the wall of some unnamed, unlisted underground detention facility, watching as some of those selfsame humans played games with your boyfriend and co-conspirator. These are not your average games. They involve pliers and glowing wires and body parts that were not designed to detach. You wish by now that your lover were dead, like the two others in your cell whose parts are scattered about the room. But they're not letting that happen. They're having too much fun. That's what it all comes down to. This is not an interrogation. There are less invasive ways to get more reliable answers. These are simply a few more sadistic thugs with authority, killing time and other things, and you can only cry and squeeze your eyes tight and whimper like an animal, even though they haven't laid a hand on you yet. You can only wish that they hadn't saved you for last, because you know what that means. But suddenly your tormentors stop in mid-game and cock their heads as if listening to some collective inner voice. Presumably it tells them to take you off the wall, bring you into the next room, and sit you down at one of the 2 gel-padded chairs on opposite sides of a smart desk, because this is what they do, far more gently than you'd expect, before retiring. You can also assume that whoever is given these instructions is both powerful and displeased, because all the arrogant, sadistic cockiness is drained from their faces in the space of a heartbeat. You sit and wait. The table glows with soft, cryptic symbols that would be of no earthly interest to you even if you could understand them, even if they contained the very secret of the vampires themselves. Some small part of you wonders if this latest development might be cause for hope. The rest of you doesn't dare believe it. You hate yourself for caring about your own survival when chunks of your friends and allies are still warm on the other side of the wall. A stocky, amarind woman appears in the room with you, clad in nondescript military weave. Her hair is buzzed short, her throat veined with the faint mesh of sub-Q antennae. Your brainstem sees that she is 10 meters tall, even though some impertinent gelatinous overlay insists that she is of only average height. The name tag on her left breast says Bates. You see no sign of rank. Bates extracts a weapon from its sheath on her thigh. You flinch, but she does not point it at you. She sets it on the desk, easily within your reach, and sits across from you. A microwave pistol, fully charged, unlocked. On its lowest setting, it causes sunburn and nausea. On its highest, it flash boils brains and the skull. At any setting in between, it inflicts pain and injury in increments as fine as your imagination. Your imagination has been retooled for great sensitivity along such scales. You stare numbly at the gun, trying to figure the trick. Two of your friends are dead, Bates says, as though you haven't just watched them die. Irrevocably so. Irrevocably dead. Good one. We could reconstitute the bodies, but the brain damage... Bates clears her throat as if uncomfortable, as if embarrassed. It's a surprisingly human gesture for a monster. We're trying to save the other one. No promises. We need information, she says, cutting to the chase. Of course. What came before was psychology softening up. Bates is the good cop. I've got nothing to tell you, you manage. It's 10% defiance, 90% deduction. They wouldn't have been able to catch you in the first place unless they already knew everything. Then we need an arrangement, Bates says. We need to come to some kind of accommodation. She has to be kidding. Your incredulity must be showing. Bates addresses it. I'm not completely unsympathetic. My gut doesn't much like the idea of swapping reality for simulation, and it doesn't buy that what-is-truth spin the body economics sells to get around it. Maybe there's a reason to be scared. Not my problem, not my job, just my opinion, and it could be wrong. But if we kill each other in the meantime, we don't find out either way. It's unproductive. You see the dismembered bodies of your friends. You see pieces on the floor, still a little bit alive, and this cunt has the nerve to talk about productivity. We didn't start it, you say. I don't know and I don't care. Like I said, it's not my job. Bates jerks a thumb over her shoulder at a door in the wall behind her, the door she must have entered through. In there, she says, are the ones who killed your friends. They've been disarmed. When you go through that door, the room will go offline and remain unmonitored for a period of 60 seconds. Nobody besides yourself will ever hold you accountable for whatever happens in there during that time. It's a trick. It has to be. What do you have to lose? Bates wonders. We can already do anything we want to you. It's not like we need you to give us an excuse. Hesitantly, you take the gun. Bates doesn't stop you. She's right, you realize. You have absolutely nothing to lose. You stand and, suddenly fearless, point the weapon at her face. Why go in there? I can kill you right here. She shrugs. You could try. Waste of an opportunity, if you ask me. So I go in there, and I come out in 60 seconds, and then what? Then we talk. We just think of it as a gesture of good faith, she says. Restitution, even. The door opens at your approach, closes in your wake. And there they are, all four of them, spread up across the wall like a chorus line of Christs on crosses. There is no gleam in those eyes now. There's only a bright animal terror and the reflection of turned tables. Two of the Christs stain their pants when you look them in the eye. What's left? Maybe 50 seconds? It's not a lot. You could have done so much more with just a little extra time.
But it's enough, and you don't want to impose on the good graces of this Bates woman. Because she may at last be someone you can deal with. Under other circumstances, Lieutenant Amanda Bates would have been court-martialed and executed within the month, no matter that the four who died had been guilty of multiple counts of rape, torture, and homicide. That's just what people did in wartime. It's what they'd always done. There was nothing polite about war, no honorable code beyond the chain of command and the circling of wagons. Deal with indiscretions if you must, punish the guilty if you have to, for appearance, if nothing else. But for God's sake, close the doors first. Never give your enemy the satisfaction of seeing discord in the ranks. Show them nothing but unity and flinty-eyed resolve. There may be murderers and rapists in our midst, but by God, they're our murderers and rapists. You certainly don't give the right of revenge to some terrorist twat with over 100 friendly scalps on her belt. Still, it was hard to argue with results. A negotiated ceasefire with the third largest realist franchise in the hemisphere. An immediate 46% decline in terrorist activities throughout the affected territories. The unconditional cancellation of several in-progress campaigns that could have seriously compromised three major catacombs and taken out the Duluth staging grounds entirely. All because Lieutenant Amanda Bates, feeling her way through her first field command, had gambled on empathy as a military strategy. It was collaborating with the enemy. It was treason. It was betrayal of the rank and file. Diplomats and politicians were supposed to do those things, not soldiers. Still, results. It was all there in the record. Initiative, creativity, a willingness to succeed by whatever means necessary and at whatever cost. Perhaps those inclinations needed to be punished, perhaps only tempered. The debate might have gone on forever if the story hadn't leaked. But it had, and suddenly the generals had a hero on their hands. Sometime during her court-martial, Bates's death sentence turned into a rehabilitation. The only question was whether it would take place in the stockade or officers' college. As it turned out, Leavenworth had both. It took her to its bosom and squeezed hard enough to virtually guarantee promotion if it didn't kill her first. 3 years later, Major Bates was bound for the stars, where she was heard to say, "We're breaking and entering, Siri." Spindle was not the first to register doubts. Others had wondered whether her assignment owed as much to superior qualifications as it did to the resolution of inconvenient PR. I, of course, had no opinion one way or the other, but I could see how she might strike some as a double-edged sword. When the fate of the world hangs in the balance, you want to keep an eye on anyone whose career-defining moment involves consorting with the enemy. If you can see it, chances are it doesn't exist. Kate Keogh, grounds for suicide. 5 times we did it. Over 5 consecutive orbits, we threw ourselves between the monster's jaws, let it chew at us with a trillion microscopic teeth, until Theseus reeled us in and stitched us back together. We crept through Rorschach's belly in fits and starts, focusing as best we could on the tasks at hand, trying to ignore the ghosts that tickled our midbrains. Sometimes the walls flexed subtly around us. Sometimes we only thought they did. Sometimes we took refuge in our diving bell while waves of charge and magnetism spiraled languidly past, like boluses of ectoplasm coursing down the intestine of some poltergeist god. Sometimes we got caught in the open. The gang would squabble among itself, uncertain which persona was which. Once I fell into a kind of waking paralysis while alien hands dragged me away down a hall. Fortunately, other hands brought me home, and voices that claimed to be real told me I'd made the whole thing up. 2 times Amanda Bates found God, saw the fucker right there in front of her, knew beyond any shadow of a doubt that the Creator not only existed, but spoke to her, and her alone.
Both times she lost her faith once we got her into the bell, but it was touch and go for a while. Her warrior drones, drunk on power but still under line-of-sight control, staggered from their perimeters and pointed their weapons along bearings too close for comfort. The grunts died fast. Some barely lasted a single foray. A few died in minutes. The longest lived were the slowest on the draw, half-blind, thick-witted, every command and response bottlenecked by raw high-frequency sound buzzing across their shielded eardrums. Sometimes we backed them up with others that spoke optically, faster but nervous and even more vulnerable. Together they guarded against an opposition that had not yet shown its face. It hardly had to. Our troops fell even in the absence of enemy fire. We worked through it all, through fits and hallucinations and occasional convulsions. We tried to watch each other's backs while magnetic tendrils tugged our inner ears and made us seasick. Sometimes we vomited into our helmets. Then we'd just hang on, white-faced, sucking sour air through clenched teeth while the recyclers filtered chunks and blobs from our headspace. And we'd give silent thanks for the small mercy of non-stick static repellent faceplates. It rapidly became obvious that my presence served as more than cannon fodder. It didn't matter that I lacked the gang's linguistic skills or Spindle's expertise in biology. I was another set of hands in a place where anyone could be laid out at a moment's notice. The more people Saresti kept in the field, the greater the odds that at least one of them would be halfway functional at any given moment. Even so, we were in barely any condition to accomplish anything. Every incursion was an exercise in reckless endangerment. We did it anyway. It was that or go home. The work proceeded in infinitesimal increments, hamstrung on every front. The gang wasn't finding any evidence of signage or speech to decipher, but the gross mechanics of this thing were easy enough to observe. Sometimes Rorschach partitioned itself, extruded ridges around its passageways like the cartilaginous hoops encircling a human trachea. Over hours, some of them might develop into contracting irises, into complete septa, lazy as warm candle wax. We seemed to be witnessing the growth of the structure in discrete segments. Rorschach grew mainly from the tips of its thorns. We'd made our incursion hundreds of meters from the nearest, but evidently the process extended at least this far back. If it was part of the normal growth process, though, it was a feeble echo of what must have been going on in the heart of the apical zones. We couldn't observe those directly, not from inside. Barely 100 meters toward the thorn, the tube grew too lethal even for suicidal flesh. But over those 5 orbits, Rorschach grew by another 8%, as mindless and mechanical as a growing crystal. Through it all, I tried to do my job. I compiled and collated, massaged data I would never understand. I watched the systems around me as best I could, factored each tick and trait into the mix. One part of my mind produced synopses and syntheses, while another watched, incredulous and uncomprehending. Neither part could trace where those insights had come from. It was difficult, though. Saresti wouldn't let me back outside the system. Every observation was contaminated by my own confounding presence in the mix. I did my best. I made no suggestions that might affect critical decisions. In the field, I did what I was told to, and no more. I tried to be like one of Bates's drones, a simple tool with no initiative and no influence on the group dynamic. I think I pulled it off, for the most part. My non-sights accumulated on schedule and piled up in Theseus's transmission stack, unsent. There was too much local interference to get a signal through to Earth.
This ends Disc 5.